Jules, we're back, almost back to a very different world because yeah. I think when we last did the show, there was one major European league that had stopped operations. That was Serie A. Now it feels like it's not just every other Big Five league. It's I think it's almost every league in Europe. And we'll get to the ones that have kept going. We've got borders being closed. We've got at least two countries, soon more, on total lockdown. Yep. And it's something that's, you know, if you're listening to us from different parts of the world, maybe, you know, you might have already been through a lot of this. If you're in Singapore or Taiwan or Korea, if you're in Italy, you've been going through this for a while. If you're in the United States, it's probably starting to hit you where you are. This is something that we're all dealing with. Now, the reason we're going to talk about this today is the impact it has on football and how things might unfold. But I think it goes to say you agree with me at the top that your public health comes first across the top. So we're not discounting that in any way.
No, just stay at home, you know, be safe, take all the precautions. You can just listen to all the Gabs and Jules podcasts since the start of the season to, like, you know, keep you entertained. But more seriously, it's very important that people think about their own health before and the health of others as well. Don't take any stupid risk in doing things that are not recommended. You know, if people say you should stay at home, then don't do like Parisian people did at the weekend where it looked like they were just on holidays, partying with each other all the time.
Now, we're going to get a better sense of what's happening because people have a lot of questions about, you know, are the domestic leagues going to be wrapped up? How will they be wrapped up? When will they be wrapped up? And what about the Euros? UEFA are holding a meeting on Tuesday. It's obviously a video conferencing meeting. They're going to speak to all 55 FIFA member associations. Mm-hmm. They're going to speak to stakeholders, which means the European Clubs Association, representing 240-odd clubs in Europe. Yep. It means FIFPro, which is the umbrella organization that represents all the players' unions. I forget the acronym, but it's the organization that encompasses all the different European leagues. The official line from UEFA is that, well, look, we want to hear everybody out, what they think. We've been looking at the situation for a long time. And we want to try to get to a solution or at least a plan, you know, because the situation is continually evolving. The first most obvious thing in several leagues, including Serie A, have come out in the open. They said, well, we're going to ask them to postpone the Euros. And the idea is you postpone the Euros because hopefully you'll be able to come back to play at some point in hopefully early May. Maybe it's mid-May. There's no guarantee of this, of course. But if you do that, then you can salvage, you can reach some sort of resolution in your league, whether you may not be able to play all the fixtures, maybe you can have some sort of playoff, and you can finish off the Champions League as well. Right, logical decision, right?
Yeah, and I don't think there's anything in UEFA camp, as much as they want that Euros to happen, that they can say, no, you know what, we can't postpone it, we can't move it because of this or this or that. It's a Euros that for the first time ever, and probably the last time as well, is in 12 different cities, which means that economically the impact would be much less than if it was in one country that had...
It's diluted.
Yes, much more diluted, and those cities will still have the Euros, hopefully, in a year time, for example, in the summer 2021. So, you know, they would not lose that much. So that's... Financially, we know how important it is. So I think that's the first one where people would say, you know, it's okay, well, I think, for the 12 cities to say, it's good with us, we can postpone it and have it in 2021, right?
Yeah, and not to mention the fact that as of right now, we don't know what restrictions are going to be in place in terms of travel and whatnot.
Yeah.
I think the other point is, again, looking at it strictly from a financial lens, it's pretty important that you finish the Champions League. There's going to be different proposals. We don't know how much time you're going to have to do it. We don't know if you're going to have to play games behind closed doors. Mm. The round of 16 isn't resolved. All the return legs in the Europa Leagues have not been played. Yeah. Some of the first legs have not been played. Obviously, in the Champions League, round of 16, there's, I think, at least three games that where one leg hasn't been played. So they need to resolve that. One proposal, and I think there is some merit to this, is you finish those off. You play the second legs where you haven't even played the first leg yet, like in the Getafe Inter situation, mm-hmm. Or the Roma Seville.
Roma, yeah.
You play one leg, and you know you figure out neutral ground, whatever, and then you do the quarterfinals in one leg, mm-hmm. And then for the semifinal and final, you borrow something from the NCAA and you do like a Final Four,
yeah,
or from the Nations League,
yeah,
in some venue. Fair, reasonable.
Yeah, I think if
time allows, obviously. Like, everything we're saying here is if time allows.
Yes, exactly.
If the pandemic allows, yeah,
exactly. Because we don't know yet when anything we'll be able to.
We don't need to keep repeating that.
Yeah.
So make a note of it if you're listening.
Exactly. So if
that's a solution.
Yeah,
right?
And I think that would be a fair solution. You know, for any club, ideally you would want every fixture to be able to be played and everybody to be able
happen.
But that's not going to happen, let's be honest. And I think we need to prepare people as well that this could be a much longer interruption than what maybe we thought initially, or maybe what people are hoping, saying like, oh yeah, maybe, you know, 3rd of April we could go back. Well, we can tell you now that nothing will be played at the weekend of the 4th and 5th of April. It will be much, much longer than that. So let's get all ready to not have football for a long time, right. And other sports as well. And again, that would be fine because health is the priority. But I think your plan is a very fair plan.
It's not my plan.
No, but the plan that you just mentioned. You move the Euros out of the way, and then whenever you can play football again, you structure your remaining fixtures. You've got usually 10 in the league for most leagues, 10 or 11. You've got obviously those Champions League matches, Europa League for the teams that are in there. You've got domestic cups for some, finals, for example.
So here's one of the things. So we're going to look at this in a really more granular way about what's left to be played domestically. This is not a decision. UEFA can't make a decision for the domestic leagues.
No.
The domestic leagues do what they want. But UEFA, I suspect, will say, we need to get this wrapped up by June 30th.
Yes.
And the reason they need to get this wrapped up by June 30th is that all players on expiring contracts, obviously that's when their contracts run out. You have implications not just in terms of wages, you have implications in terms of insurance. Mm-hmm. I think what a lot of people don't want is to go and extend this out into next season. I know there's been suggestions here. Greg Dyke, who's a former head of the Football Association, and his view is that, well, no, you absolutely need to play all the fixtures. Wayne Rooney talked about, can you not extend and play into September? I think UEFA's point, and I think they're right, is the football system isn't set up for that. And I know it's an unusual situation, but you impact so many different things if you play through during the summer.
Yeah.
Right? I don't know that if you can even play, say, football in Seville, at the end of July where it's, you know, 110 degrees Fahrenheit.
Yeah.
And I think these things come into play. And also, you don't want to create something where you have a knock-on effect which affects next season and then the season after and the season after. So they're going to say, I suspect, June 30th, the European season ends. We'll have the Champions League final play by then again, if the epidemic allows.
Yeah.
And then July 15th is when, roughly mid-July, is when qualifying for next year's Europa League and Champions League starts.
Yeah.
Domestic leagues, do what you think is best, because we can't force you. But by that day, you have to tell us who's playing in next season's European Cups.
Mm.
So that if in England they decide, well, no, we're different, we're an island, we invented the game, blah, 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 we'll do things our way, as we've seen that they're doing more ways than one.
Yeah.
That's fine. But if you want your clubs to play in the Champions League next year and the Europa League, you got to get us that list by June 30th. Do it any way you want. Would that seem like a fair solution?
Yeah, definitely.
If the majority of people in England, in the FA and the club, say no, let's play out the rest of the fixture list regardless, and we want to play through July and August and the climate allows us to do it and whatever, personally I think, hey, that's fine, you do that, but in the meantime, if you want to play in Europe,
exactly,
give us the teams by June 30th.
Yeah, I think, and I think again, if you were UEFA and you just come up and say, okay, we move the Euros so we can allow all those leagues to finish and do your own business, But it's fair for us to say on June the 30th, we need to prepare for next season's European competition. So give us the names of who qualified, who won the cups. If there's no cup winner, then you give an extra space in your league table. and so, and they put the rules, and then people do what they want after that. But at least they would have that guidance. I think what people tend to forget, because people ask me, or I hear people saying, oh yeah, you know, as soon as the epidemic allows, then we can play matches again, and they can play every 3 days. Right now, I would think 95% of Europe, players are in their house. Some have mini gyms. Some don't have any gyms at all. It's not all Sergio Ramos or Cristiano Ronaldo who have a proper, like,
fully equipped
gym. So they're trying to stay fit, but they can't work too hard because they don't want their immune system, and rightly so, to be weakened.
They don't have team doctors there with them and fitness trainers.
Exactly. So they do have a program sent by every manager. So Zinedine Zidane sent one, Thomas Tuchel sent one to his players, etc., etc.
Had to get the PSG reference.
Of course. But when the season will finally be allowed to start again, those players won't be ready. Let's not kid ourselves. They won't be ready to play again every 3 days to finish the season. It will take some time. You look at the summer, after 4 weeks off of holidays, you know, they need another 6 weeks to be ready for the season. So let's not forget that they will come out of this not in the best shape or form whatsoever. I don't care if they run on the treadmill for a bit every day, or if they do cycling and peloton or whatever it's called every day. They won't be ready to play football matches at that kind of level with that kind of intensity, right?
No, it's not possible. You're going to have to work in some kind of mini preseason in that as well, I think.
Big time.
A couple weeks.
Which will take some time as well on top of everything else.
So, that being the case, and look, I mean, I have to say, England is the only place that I've heard where people are seriously talking, oh, let's keep going until September and the FA Cup and whatever. I personally, I think you need to lose the FA Cup. I mean, you're going to have to make a decision at some point. And people are going to have to decide what is important to them. I suspect that domestic cups are going to be the ones that are going to suffer, that aren't going to happen. I worked it out. If Manchester City were to reach the Champions League final and the FA Cup final, and you wouldn't bet against them doing it, they would have 21 fixtures left to play. That's just simply not possible.
Yeah, it's crazy. It's crazy.
So presumably if everything goes to plan, if they can start playing again at some point, early May, mid-May, whenever it is, a lot of leagues will have to make a decision, because I think it's very optimistic to think that they can cram in all the fixtures.
Yeah, I agree. So what would you do now? There's obviously a few options of what you could do. We saw Karen Brady, for example.
Yeah, that's not a good option.
Like, that's not a good option, but one of the options is to void the season. Let me give you the options. So that's one. And you say, listen, we can't finish the season, so the season is...
You avoid the season, no promotion, no relegation.
No promotion, no relegation. Yeah. And you just go back next season in the same format as it was this season, so same teams in Champions League.
This is if it never happened,
Okay. Second one is, you, for example, take the teams at the winter break, for example, or for England at the turn of the year, and that table is the table for the season, because you haven't finished it, so you take it. So, for example, it's one of the options that Spain seem to be thinking of. At the halfway mark of the season. The third one is, this is it, we've played 75% of the games, and we're going to take it from here. We don't play the remaining 10 league fixtures, and this is the table for us, and this is the champion, this is the team that qualified, this is who go down, and then who goes up from the second division, or you find a way. Do you see any other options, and what do you make of those three?
So,
and obviously there's the one where you can manage to play the remaining games.
Right. Well, I think there's a fifth one, which is probably the most realistic one. I'm going to get through why those first three options that you mentioned, I think, should only be considered if we can play no more football at all, if the epidemic doesn't allow us to.
Yeah.
There's a financial imperative here. Clubs obviously lose money when they don't play.
Mm-hmm.
If it's safe to play, there's no reason that they shouldn't be playing, especially since UEFA have moved the Euro and created, you know, effectively they've magicked up another 6 weeks of time,
window,
right?
Yeah.
So you have to play in that period, I think. And by the way, in terms of the losses that clubs are making, let's be very clear on this. The only money the clubs are losing right now is if games get cancelled, they lose gates.
Mm.
People are creating all sorts of scare stories, Javier Tebas in particular in Spain, talking about, oh, but we're going to lose TV revenue, we're going to lose sponsorship. You don't know that. You really don't. Because, you know, yeah, broadcasters can take legal action. Sponsors can take legal action. But I double dare a sponsor to say, like, we're going to go and take legal action against you and cut your payments because of this circumstance way beyond your control.
Yeah.
Not to mention that it's governed by contracts, and it depends how the contracts are written in terms of, because this is obviously an act of God. It's force majeure.
Yeah, of course. Right?
So I think those things are very overblown, and I think a lot of those estimates are extremely self-serving. You know, but the attitude is cross that bridge when you get to it.
Definitely.
So if you can play, but we know that you lose gate receipts. Yeah. Those vary from country to country. In the Premier League, I think it's an estimated, were they not to play another single game, it's an estimated 175 million euros spread across the 20 clubs. So it's not insubstantial. It's not enormous. It obviously impacts lower division clubs more.
Because they
rely on gate receipts more. So I think it's important to continue playing.
Yeah. But what if you can't play? If you're not allowed to?
All right. If you can't play, I think we're choosing the least bad option. If you can't play, what I think leagues are going to do is they're going to take the table as it stands.
Yeah.
I think ideally I would get some sort of mathematical nerd to come out and run some kind of analysis based on strength of schedule, based on the fact that some teams have played more games and have games in hand.
Yeah.
And do an adjusted league table. Use that to distribute the money.
In cricket, when the rain...
The Duckworth-Lewis method.
Exactly,
yeah.
The DL method. So something similar to that, right?
Yeah. I don't know that people are going to do it because fans aren't going to understand it. I would still definitely assign the title. After you run that analysis, but you would assign it. And if you want to assign it with an asterisk, assign it with an asterisk. Obviously, it seems crazy in England where Liverpool have a 25-point lead, but that's not the case in every league.
Yeah.
I wouldn't relegate anybody. And if it means that you have to take promoted teams and make the league bigger for 1 year, it's not ideal. But that may be what has to happen. I think it's going to be a case-by-case situation in every country. But I think likely in most countries we will be able to play some games. And I think what you want to do is make those games meaningful and provide some sort of closure.
Yeah.
I think one obvious solution would be just simply to split the league up by positions into different groups. They already do this in Belgium.
Yeah.
Where, you know, depending on the number of games you play, the size of your little mini league, you carry over points or some proportion of points. And in Belgium, what they do is after the regular season, they, however many points you have, they split those points into two. So you get half those points.
Yeah.
And you play the games that you're supposed to play, that the schedule allows you to play. And that helps determine the final standings. You know, you could do it if you don't play the FA Cup, obviously you'd have another Europa League spot. Maybe you take the top six. Maybe you take a middle six to deal with to competing for that final Europa League spot. And maybe, you know, the rest to avoid relegation.
Yeah. You can find a way for sure.
There are ways to do this.
Yeah,
the key thing that must guide you is obviously it has to be fair. You can't ignore what happened before. And it has to be something that people understand, and the games have to be meaningful.
Yeah.
And if you do that, you know, you can hopefully address some of these issues. I think that would be the ideal solution if you can't play out all the fixtures.
So there's a precedent, or kind of a precedent, because this scenario has never been seen before. But in Chile last year, when, if you remember, there was very violent riots, and they suspended the league six games before the end, I believe. I think it was six games before the end of the season.
Six or eight, maybe.
Maybe. And you know what they did? They never resumed the league. And they stopped it there, and they took, as you said, the table as it stood when it was stopped, with the team leading it, and they were a bit like Liverpool this season. They were like, I don't know, 25 points clear or something, and they were crown champion, and no one had anything to say about it. It was fair, and everybody agreed to the fact that it should be. So when I read Karen Brady or whoever it is, and rumors of other clubs saying like, oh, you know, we should announce this officially, the season void, and Jean-Michel Aulas in France, the Lyon chairman, has done the same as well. and just said because his team is seventh in the league, and if the season is void, then they will go back in the Champions League next season because they're in the Champions League this season. It just drives me mad. And I know you have to protect your club's interest, and I know we would all do that if we were owning Lyon or PSG or Milan or whatever. But there's a point where you have to be a decent person, a decent human being, and I was not decent.
No. And I think there are other issues. And again, maybe I'm optimistic here. Maybe I think that people are a little too good. But
too nice.
Look, in many leagues, you're competing for Champions League and Europa League places. And if you can't play another game, or if you get to the point where you have to figure out how to split teams, maybe there's another option. Maybe you get the teams around the table and you agree, okay, in the interest of our league and our UEFA coefficient, who are we going to send? Right?
Yeah.
If that means that we send Manchester United instead of Leicester because it's good for the league. I don't know, obviously, it's not a great example because Leicester have many more points, but you know what I'm saying.
If it's close, then
let's do that. And then maybe we have something where, because obviously a lot of this is about money, whatever revenue United earn gets split under some formula with Leicester.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? You choose the best teams to represent you.
Yeah.
You know.
Definitely.
I just think people have to think creatively, and all these options have to be on the table. And hopefully, you know, there's going to be fewer people like Karen Brady who, you know, are just going to go and hire a bunch of lawyers to go and tie this up in court for a long time.
Yeah.
You know, hopefully people can understand the seriousness of the situation and get the right consensus to move on. Before we move on, we have to figure out what to do with Euro 2020.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, it's moved. They're going to tentatively figure out when to move it to. Also, before that, the Champions League final. Obviously, it's not going to be played May 30th.
No.
It may still be played in Istanbul if it's going to be at the end of June.
Yeah.
We will find out. I'm slightly wary. I am not an epidemiologist, but I look at the number of cases in Turkey. I look at the fact that Turkey shares a land border with Iran, which is obviously one of the hardest hit countries.
Yeah.
I look at the way it has been spreading. Turkey might be at a different moment in time. They may be dealing with this come the end of June. So there has to be a contingency, I think, there as well.
Definitely, yeah. But you think that, yeah.
If you move the Euros and you move it to the same dates next summer, you're going to have to adjust a number of things in the schedule.
Yeah.
So the Nations League Final Four, which I personally really liked the Nations League last year.
But it's not the priority either.
It's not going to be the priority. I agree with you. There's some World Cup qualifying games. Hopefully you can reach some understanding with FIFA.
Yeah.
There's the but then the other two I think are slightly more problematic.
Yeah,
one is the women's, well, there's the European under-21s.
Yeah.
Okay, fine. One is the Women's Euros, which is scheduled in England, which kicks off, I believe, on July 5th.
Yeah.
So there would be an overlap of about a week until the end of the tournament. I think, as well as, it's not just the overlap, I think all the media attention is going to be on the men's Euros.
Mm-hmm.
You're not going to get the build up to the women's Euros.
The coverage of the, they would usually get.
What I think they should consider doing is moving the women's Euros then to 2022. Argument being is, there literally will be nothing that summer.
Yeah, because the World Cup is obviously a bit later.
Because it's a winter World Cup.
Yeah, exactly. So that would work. That would work.
Again, crunch the numbers.
Yeah.
But you don't want to create a situation where you're having a women's Euro. You've got this great wave of interest and enthusiasm in women's football, and then you just cannibalize it by parking the men's Euro
at the same
on top
time.
Of it.
Yeah.
And I know people are going to say, well, why don't you move the men's Euro to Euro 2022? Well, it's very simple, because they're going to have a World Cup 4 months later, whereas the Women's World Cup isn't until 2023.
Yeah.
The other issue is, of course, the inaugural FIFA Club World Cup. It's going to be held in China. It kicks off, I think, because it's set to kick off mid-June. You're going to have 24 teams.
That's a new version, the first year of the
new version. Eight of them are big European teams. It's going to be very lucrative for teams participating in it. There's a whole political backdrop to this, which is kind of a power struggle between UEFA and FIFA, Sheffrin and Gianni Infantino. Logic from a UEFA standpoint suggests, all right, that's got to go.
Yeah.
But then again, there's teams in Africa, in South America, and CONCACAF who are saying, well, wait a minute, we were promised this.
Yeah.
So what do you do?
Yeah, that's a big one. I mean, you know it better than me, but I don't know what the relationship on over something like this, where there's so much money at stake, and there's also at stake, not just the money, but also a sense of superiority between UEFA and FIFA, of like, who's going to let go? Because FIFA can stand and say, okay, well, great for you Euros, but we don't care. We also have our own competitions to run here. And why would we give you the space of the new FIFA World Cup, that the new FIFA Clubs World Cup that we've spent so much time and already so much money organizing, finding a right way, having clubs on board, this and that, for now to just put it on the bin or move it to another date just for your UEFA competition? So who would win between FIFA and UEFA?
It's a tricky one. I mean, UEFA are increasingly aligned with CONMEBOL, so South America in many ways. We presume the Copa America has to move as well.
Yeah.
So I think they could make a pretty strong stand. The other thing is, FIFA Club World Cup is only going to be lucrative if you have those eight big European teams in it, and the big South American teams. They're going to control the balance of power. We don't know who those eight European teams are because there's been different talk about different criteria. Mm. I think we can safely assume that Real Madrid and Liverpool are going to be two of them because obviously they won the Champions League.
And the champions of at least the five big leagues should be there, you think?
Who knows? Who knows? I mean, that's all TBD. Right now, it doesn't even seem that relevant, honest. But I would appeal to those clubs right now and say, because those clubs are going to say, well, wait a minute. So I can release my players for the Euros and not get a dime out of it, or I can follow FIFA instructions and send them to the Club World Cup where I'm going to make between 50 and 100 million.
Yeah.
Well, gee, duh, it's a no-brainer.
Yeah.
I'm going to appeal to their sense of altruism and their sense of being a part of a bigger whole, that if it comes down to this, you find a solution and you don't just look after yourself and the money you're going to make from the FIFA Club World Cup. Because obviously, it might come down to these clubs choosing UEFA over FIFA or vice versa.
Yeah.
And I think it's important that fans care about this. They make their voices heard. Mm-hmm. Two other solutions that have been suggested. One would be having a winter break, so to speak, in mid-season, in 2020-2021, next season, and playing the Euros then. I think that's kind of weird and odd and unwieldy.
So that would be at the same time as the Africa Cup of Nations, right?
Yes.
Who would be in January and
February. Yeah, so the advantage is obviously people are stopping Africa Cup of Nations, those guys are leaving, and that's not my preferred option. One other thing they could do, it might be a little less lucrative, and obviously you'd be scrapping the Nations League for a season, but it's still a UEFA competition, is you've got six slots, right? You've got three international breaks, September, October, November, two games each. You could play group games and round of 16 and whatnot there, and then you play the Final Four in place of the Nations League Final Four.
Yeah, that's a possibility because, again, as we said, because it's in 12 cities, you could easily do that. It would be like an away trip.
I don't think anybody's going to want to go to Baku. They don't want to go now. Yeah, that's something that's viable. I think in some way it would almost be like an homage, as you might say, to the original European championships. These are things to think about. We'll
know a bit better on Tuesday morning after that meeting.
We'll know Wednesday morning.
On Wednesday.
Maybe. I think it is something to consider. Jules, when you talk about football's reaction as well in terms of the authorities, now the line has been overall, and I think with some justification, that football federations and leagues and clubs, they're not governments, they're not epidemiologists, they're not doctors. They follow the official advice. I think it's a way of them to cover their rear ends as well. Mm-hmm. And we had a situation last week. Wayne Rooney wrote about this very eloquently.
Very well in the Sunday Times,
He is angry. He said, why does it take Mikel Arteta late Thursday night announcing that he has tested positive for the coronavirus for football to shut down? Now, the government advice here in the United Kingdom until that point has been we're not going to ban large gatherings. Eventually, later, they did, and of course, they banned the large gatherings, though, and it still is. because over a certain number you have to have X amount of ambulances and police there, and this way they can keep them free. They're not banning them because of the risk of exposure or contagion. Different people have different opinions on that. I'm just going to say it's rather different advice and reasoning and logic as applied most of the rest of the world.
Yeah, they chose a different strategy to
maybe
our
they're right.
Immunity. Yeah,
who knows? But I do find it extraordinary that when you know the entire Arsenal squad is at risk because Evangelos Marinakis, the Olympiacos owner, who, you know, when Olympiacos played against Arsenal, he later came out and he said, "Look, I've tested positive." That you're just going to wait. You're going to wait. You're going to wait until Friday morning to suspend everything. You're going to wait for one of these guys to test positive when people have been quarantined and are in self-isolation. I think Rooney has a point.
Yeah.
And I am surprised how passive a lot of these footballers have been.
And the first point is, why is Wayne Rooney the first one really to come out so strongly against those crazy decisions from the Premier League and the EFL as well, to have wanting to play for so long? I mean, let's not forget, 48 minutes before the Arsenal statement on Mikel Arteta, the Premier League had a statement themselves saying everything is going to go like normal, like if nothing had happened. We're going to have all the Premier League games this weekend, none behind closed doors, with all the fans, all around. This is like, and you were thinking already, really?
Do you think the players are kind of passive on this, or do you think they've been told by the clubs, don't express an opinion on what the Premier League are doing?
I
find it extraordinary that you've got 20 clubs, you've got 500 Premier League players, and nobody comes out and says, what the hell are we doing? Why are we playing? You don't even have one scaredy cat, what's the hypochondriac? It takes Wayne Rooney,
right. I don't know. Yeah.
Who's 34 years old, however old he is, who's made all his money, who's in the championship, and who is kind of the master of his domain at Derby County.
Yeah.
He's got nothing to lose, for him to come out and speak. And that's pretty extraordinary.
And it's pretty bad from all those players, like you said, all those big stars, whoever, who, unless they maybe didn't realize how bad the situation was, and maybe they thought, yeah, we can, you know, England seems to be a bit behind everybody else, and we can put, a lot of those players have families in Italy, in Spain, in France, in Germany. They would see the damage that the virus has already done there, and they were thinking like, they should not even have wanted to play. Someone should have come and said, I don't want to play, I don't want to travel to Brighton on Saturday, I don't want to go there, I don't want to go there. And that, it was just, it was nothing.
I find it extraordinary, and even, for those who watched the clip of Jurgen Klopp losing his cool with our colleague Martin Einstein, when he was asked in the pre-match press conference ahead of the Atletico game, when he was asked, you know, well, how do you feel about, you know, Spain's on lockdown, players coming here? And he kind of like, well, where are you coming from? You came from Spain. Huh? I thought it was one of those situations where I couldn't understand what point Klopp was trying to make.
Yeah, I agree.
Other than, I felt to me, maybe just because I like Klopp and I'm biased here, but I think he's like, oh, young man, there's so much crap I want to tell you about decisions that are being made, but I simply cannot right now. I mean,
it sounded a bit like that.
That's how it sounded to me.
Yeah, I agree with you completely. Like almost he could not say exactly what he was thinking of, like, this game should never be on anyway. You know, and I have to say, I went there, and I did think, sat there, and I had the PSG game on the iPad, and I was like, their stadium is empty. We're here. There's like, I don't know, 55,000 people in this stadium. 3,000 of them come from Spain, which is the second most European country with the most positive.
And which is officially on lockdown.
Officially on lockdown. They're here. They're like, actually, you know, they're just there.
Right.
You know, I've just did my live here for French TV, literally 15 yards from them. And I'm like, and I think maybe Klopp, you're right, maybe Klopp was thinking, we should never be here. We should never have a press conference here in the first place. Why that press conference was on, when a few other press conferences, like before the PSG Dortmund game again, was completely cancelled, and yet Klopp had to answer those questions. Maybe he was thinking, I don't want to be here with you Spanish people, for example. No offense to Spanish people, but you know, he might have felt like not safe.
I don't think he wants to be surrounded by English people either.
Yeah,
he wants to be surrounded
by
anybody. He wants to be at home in Klopp Castle, with his family in isolation and following the advice that most people, including people in Germany, which is where he's from, has been given.
Yeah.
And I think this is what leads to so much confusion, especially in the Premier League, which is the most well, by far the most international league in the world, both in terms of the number of players, the number of coaches, the number of owners, there are a lot of people who are answering the same question. Yeah. I mean, Angelo Bonna spoke out about it, a few others. It's pretty extraordinary. And I think when all this is over, I think a lot of people might want to review some of the practices and the way things have gone. Jules, we normally do a Champions League look back. It feels like it was an eternity ago when they played those round of 16 games. But you know what? It gives us a chance to talk about football.
Yeah, which is a football game, yeah.
Which is kind of nice. Well, of the matches that actually were played, what surprised you? I mean, obviously, I suppose we got to start with Atletico Madrid.
Yeah.
Going to Liverpool.
Yeah, I was at the game. It was a bit surreal because obviously at the same night, PSG Dortmund was behind closed doors and at Anfield, the atmosphere was pretty impressive. 3,000 Atletico fans traveled from Spain for the game. They had an Everton flag in their away end as well. But the atmosphere was incredible and there was a sense that I felt from the beginning that Liverpool, the players, the fans, the staff, everybody knew that at some point they would make, you know, they would come back into the game, into the tie, they would score a goal, maybe two, and then the game would be over. Atleti, although it looked
like they had so many chances.
Yeah, I mean, they had...
They dominated that game.
They had 62 crosses, I think. They had 34 shots. I think 11 on target. Jan Oblak made 10 or 11 saves, which is the most he's ever made in a Champions League game or something like that. It was the numbers, if you just look at the numbers, the possession, which was, I think, 77% in the first half
expected
of that.
Expected goals.
Yeah, expected goals, everything. If you look at just the stats, Liverpool just bossed that game from start to finish. Yeah, they lost 3-2.
But even if you watch the game, they bossed it.
Yeah, of course, even if you watch it.
Hey, I'm just curious, because we talked about how Liverpool hadn't been going through... They simply hadn't played well in a long time. And then they suddenly turned it on for this game. And you know, like, who knows when we'll see them play again. That's something that really impressed me. Because you have this whole negative vibe going through you, which, you know, just, even when they were winning, they weren't playing well.
Yeah.
And then suddenly when it mattered, and maybe people say I'm too obsessed with performances over results, but then when it mattered...
Completely.
They were outstanding.
They were amazing.
And I know I'll get messages from Muppets saying, yeah, but if we can finishing
yeah,
is part
yeah,
of the game.
Yeah, and of course but, it is. You know. But if you look at the content and the performance in itself, it was certainly their best performance in the last 4 months, I think, without a doubt. Maybe the best performance since the City game in the league.
Isn't it mad Marcos Llorente scoring two goals?
So
like
what?
The least likely guy to score.
Yeah. Do you want to know what makes me... drove me mad at the game, and I saw it straight away. I didn't need a replay on
Adrian.
No, because people keep blaming Adrian. Oh, fair enough. Of course, he should clear the board. But what is Trent Alexander-Arnold doing on the first goal? When Joao Felix gets the ball and does this very nice like inside pass to Marcos Llorente, Trent Alexander-Arnold at that time is literally shoulder to shoulder with Llorente, and then he stops. And then there's no more pressure from him on Llorente before the shot. Let me finish. There's no pressure from him. He literally stops. He stops running. And Llorente has suddenly a couple of yards ahead of him and can hit that shot very easily and score the goal. The second goal on that counter attack from Morata. Good movement from Morata. He does everything great. Good movement from Llorente. The two of them, Henderson and Joe Gomez. And both of them are no point in the attack. Put any pressure on Llorente for the second goal. Even to the point that he's on his left foot and he's a right-footed player. He's on his left foot and instead of showing him on that side, on his left side, they allow him to go back on his right foot and shoot. I mean, come on.
I have to agree with you.
At that level? Come on.
I was really surprised by, you know, again, Adrian is the guy who's going to be crucified.
Of course.
And whatever. But Joe Gomez, man.
Henderson and Trent as well. If you watch it again, it's a disgrace the way they defend on those two goals.
Paris Saint-Germain, Borussia Dortmund. I was confident for Paris Saint-Germain.
You were more than me.
Are you gonna apologize to all the two Felicitas?
No, it's not that. I didn't think they had
performance. It wasn't as close as the score suggests. Sorry.
No, they were much better. I think Borussia Dortmund had no shot on targets in the second half, for example. But in terms of discipline, in terms of collectiveness, togetherness, that sort of working together team spirit of, you might be great on the ball, and they all are. It's a very talented team on the ball. But if you don't play as a team, you're never going to go anywhere, right? And I think for many years, not just with Tuchel, but with Emery as well, and even with Blanc before that, they hardly played as a team in those big games. And to see them doing it on Wednesday with no fans in the stadium was
maybe that's why.
Yeah, maybe. But the ultras were fantastic before the game for the people who haven't seen all the footage. I'm sure everybody has, but in the way they still supported the team, yeah, and
not
the,
so fantastic congregating.
No, I know, but
noise,
yeah,
I mean.
But the communion after the game was great. The way Neymar behaved was great, not just the goal, but everything. And then there was the trolling. Can I just have a couple of minutes on the trolling? Because people said, oh, look at your team. They're disgraced. They're trolling a 19-year-old kid in Haaland because they reproduced his goal celebration. Let's not forget, after the first leg that Dortmund won 2-1 at home, who were trolling who?
Dortmund, but those are wacky German social media accounts.
Yeah, of course. So that doesn't count,
look,
right?
So much fun.
Because Axel Witsel, you know, had a go at PSG, and Emre Can said that he wanted to play Juventus in the next round, and last weekend, and Watzke, and the official Dortmund account themselves were saying French said, et voilà, with a 2-1 win. Okay, who are you gonna troll now? Who are you gonna troll? If you troll people, get ready to get trolled, right?
Oh yeah.
Be
oh,
ready
yeah.
to get trolled. That's the oh, way yeah. it works. Otherwise, don't troll. And
no
one will troll you.
I don't think people are genuinely upset about it.
I don't know. I got a few comments on social media. People are saying, like, oh, your team is dead. Disgraced.
If you're going to be like, oh, you're being mean to Haaland, believe me what, the beast can handle it.
Exactly.
Erling Brown Haaland can
handle that's the
any
way.
Any kind of verbals you throw at him.
Exactly. What about Josip Bilicic? Because although that game at Valencia was behind closed doors again and all of that, but for him, at 32 years of age, to go out like this in a Champions League last 16 second leg, and okay, the game was pretty much won, we would say, after the first leg, but still, and score 4 goals, it's just incredible, isn't it?
It's, I mean, the whole Atlanta story is crazy. I wrote a piece about this afterwards, about how this really shouldn't work. It shouldn't work for 101 different reasons. They shouldn't be in this position. You know, normally when you have underdog stories, and this is a tremendous underdog story, normally you have outstanding individuals who are going to go to the next level. Honestly, apart from maybe Robin Gosens, and, you know, how excited you're going to get about a 25-year-old German fullback, none of these guys are going to another level. You know, their race is run.
Yeah.
And what I love is, you know, you think of Vilicic and Papu Gomez. Those are two guys who throughout their career, people look at Ilicic and says, meh, yeah, okay, you got straight.
He's got great left foot.
But you know what? You don't have the personality for it. You know, you're flaky. There's a whole tradition of, as we love stereotyping in football, there's a whole tradition of tall East European-y types with whose names end in ick.
Yeah.
You know, look, let's face it. It's the same knock that Zlatan Ibrahimovic had for the first 10 years.
Yeah, of course.
You know, but before he became the Wolfman or whatever he is, you know. And Ilicic is just showing that, you know what, this is my level. After being nobody believing in his, they always recognized his talent, but they didn't believe he had the personality or the cojones to go and make this work. Papu Gomez, who I think is a phenomenal player.
Yeah, I agree.
Too small. The guy's smaller than Messi, you know. He won his first cap for Argentina 2 years ago. Do you know some of the absolute Muppets who've gotten caps for Argentina in the last couple of years? The guy had to wait until he was 32 years old, passed over by every big team time and again because he's too little.
I know.
There's so many wonderful stories like that in Atalanta. It really kind of is a collection of waifs, strays, no names, people who had shots at bigger clubs and then were sent back, like Duvan Zapata, like Mario Pasalic, who technically I think is still a Chelsea player.
After like 25 loans.
Yeah, I know. It's tremendous. And since I know you like your social media, of course, this is a team that has not one, but two players who have recorded successful music videos.
Yeah.
And you can choose which one you like. Because, of course, Papu Gomez has his Papu dance.
Yeah.
Which is extremely catchy. And, Angolini, the goalkeeper, has his own slightly, probably more traditional old school rap.
Yeah.
But it's pretty sweet.
And Gasperini, a word on Gasperini, because he's the architect, right, of everything. And, you know, I know Papu Gomez and Iličić are hitting their peak now, 32, when maybe nobody expected it, but he's the guy who's put not just that team together, but also the philosophy, the style of play, which is a very high intense.
It's critical. Look, nobody plays like this in Europe. Nobody. Nobody, certainly no team with this talent plays like that. No, but you know, they understand a very basic concept that even if I create one-on-one battles all over the pitch, even if you're better than me, it's not such a bad thing if I have the one-on-one. Conceding a one-on-one with an average defender against a very good striker in the open field, which, you know, most clubs say, oh no, that's terrible.
Yeah.
You know, you look at the numbers, it's actually difficult to beat a player and get your shot off and score. Mm-hmm. And sometimes the advantage that you get at the other pitch, at the other end of the pitch, makes it worth it. I think it's tremendous. I think they've scored against, people say, oh, they haven't played that many great defenses. Well, they've scored against every big team they faced this season, from Manchester City to Juventus to the other teams in Serie A. So I think it's just a wonderful story, and I hope we get to see them again this season.
And also for Bergamo, who's one of the region the most hit by the virus back in Italy.
Absolutely.
He must give people a lot of love and hope as well.
Absolutely. Finally, Leipzig.
I mean, who thought that Spurs could go there and do something? No one did, right?
Not just Mourinho, obviously.
Clearly, yeah.
No, look, they were professional. They were in control from the first minute.
Yeah.
The vibe from Spurs was, oh, we're not going to turn this around, which was the wrong attitude. I know you have a billion guys injured.
Yeah, but still.
But equally, this doesn't mean you have to put out that kind of team, play in that way. That reaction from Ndombele that we were expecting.
Nope.
Doesn't get on the pitch.
So. Stay on the bench. I thought Mourinho after the game smiling and saying, oh, well, they were very good at the back. They were very good in midfield. They were very good. And I know we're going to address it as well in the quick hits. But, I mean, for me, there was the difference between a team forward thinking and a manager forward thinking, who was idea, who was a structure, who was, I mean, the way they play, how they use the whole width of the pitch, those five, bands or lines, whatever you want to call it, for the movement and the passing and everything is just sensational. And on the other hand, you have a team with no creativity, no idea, a manager that lives in the past, a team that's going nowhere right now, even with all those injuries. I know, but I don't think they would have changed anything, really. Maybe instead of being 4-0 on aggregate, it would have maybe just been 2, but...
I don't have a problem with the way he plays if he thinks it's the right way.
It's not the right way either, right?
I have a problem with the vibe he gives. This continuous negativity that, you know, screw it. Go out there and try to play. If you lose, you lose. Nobody expects anything from you.
Yeah, exactly.
You know?
That's what is the wrong...
Such an odd situation to be in. From the Champions League to slightly different type of football, Mark Ogden is up next. Jules, as promised, now we're going to talk to Mark Ogden, joining us from his secret hideaway in Rochdale.
Yep.
Now, Augie did something this past weekend that I didn't do, you didn't do, partly because it would have been a pain in the butt for us to seek out games at this level where we live, but also partly because we followed advice about crowds and whatever.
Yeah.
Augie did not. Augie, you wrote a piece on this. You went to a seventh tier football match because, of course, the Premier National kept going. They kept playing this weekend in England, even after the Premier League and EFL called off matches. Is that right?
Yeah. So the Northern Premier League is the seventh tier, and the National League, which is the fifth tier, was slow going ahead, but quite a few clubs refused to play in the National League. So I think half the games were called off. So I decided to go to a National League game on the basis that, you know, people will want to go to football. If you want something hard enough, you'll find it. And it was the only game in Greater Manchester, in almost the north of England, because there was a lot of games called off. So, yeah, I take your point that I ignored official advice. But the official advice in the UK, as you know, is that large gatherings aren't a problem. It's just a problem in terms of the strain it puts on the emergency services who have to attend large gatherings in excess of 500. So went to the game, 480 turned up, so it might even be able to go ahead next week as far as I know. And yeah, it was interesting, it was good fun, and it might be the last time for a while though.
Now, I was struck by the fact that you quoted somebody who described themselves as a Wolves fan.
Yeah.
Who went there with his kid, I think, and he said, you know, oh, I'm having football withdrawal, or you know, I wanted to find some football, and I this was nearby or whatever. Did you obviously got the sense in the story that a big chunk of the people who showed up were people who just wanted to watch football and maybe knew nothing about the two teams, or you know, weren't regular fans.
Yeah, absolutely. And if I want to drop some names here, there were Frank Sinclair, the ex-Chelsea player, was there. Kevin Campbell, the ex-Everton player, and Andy Dawson, the ex-Hull player. So I have no idea what they were doing there, because it's not a sort of game where they'd find players if they were scouting for Premier League clubs. But it was, strange times make people do strange things, I guess. And whether they thought, I need to see some football, or I just need to get out of the house, I'm not so sure. But it was interesting. And the fact that, you know, there's a 25% bigger attendance for that game than they would normally get. So clearly, a lot of people walked up and decided they wanted to watch a football match. So, and there was no sense that I found that people were feeling that they were taking risks, or that they were, you're doing something they shouldn't be doing. Perhaps it's, I don't know, maybe it's a British thing, maybe it's the sense that we haven't been told what the reality is, or there's an element of ignorance. But the view is basically, well, you know, we'll be okay for now. It's, you know, we're fine. And there is a bit of an ignorance and naivety there, but that is the reality. We can't hide from that. We can't say that everyone has the same view of it. A lot of people think that this has been blown out of proportion, and that's their view.
Did you think that there would be more games next weekend, or that was the last time they could play until for a while, like the other leagues, or would they keep going to try to play if there's less than 500 people coming to the games?
Well, I spoke to the Whitby chairman after the game, and he said there's a meeting today. There's a Northern Premier League meeting where he expects games to be called off. Now, Radcliffe are supposed to play Grantham Town on Tuesday, but one of the Grantham players is, according to people at Radcliffe, showing symptoms of COVID-19, so that game's off. So I just think that they will be sensible, and everyone's basically waiting for government advice. But one of the interesting things that the Whitby chairman told me was that at that level, the players' contracts end as soon as the season ends. So their last game of the season is due to be April 26th. That is when the players' contracts end. It isn't like in the Premier League or across Europe where it's June 30th. April 26th, last game, contract end. Which means that these clubs don't have to find money for 3 months during the season to pay wages, because even though it's maybe £20,000 a week, it's still a lot of money for clubs at that level. And I've no idea how they sustain it. And, you know, if Radcliffe are getting 350 people a week, how they pay wages of £200-300 a week to players, I don't know. But the view is that if the league is cancelled today, the Northern Premier League, then the season will end, so players will not be entitled to pay from this point on. So players who are part-time, who, you know, that they've got jobs in the real world, builders, firemen, dentists, fitness instructors, all sorts, they're getting paid maybe an extra £200-300 a week on top of their regular income. That's going to be a big hole in their income, but, you know, there is a bigger issue. But basically what the Whitby chairman was telling us that if the league ends today, then these clubs will get a month where they don't have to pay wages, and ultimately that can keep these clubs afloat. And I know that this isn't the biggest deal right now, where, you know, a seven-tier football club survives, but, you know, when we get back to real life and the real world again, the fact that they had such a big crowd on Saturday shows that football is escapism that people need. You know, I think we will discover in the next few weeks how important sport is to people, and how, as trivial as it is, how important it is.
Well, it's gonna quote Carlo Ancelotti, which Jurgen Klopp stole from him, although I'm sure Carlo stole it from somebody else, saying that it's the most important of the unimportant things in life. But it's a good point you make about, and I often struggle with this, especially, you know, when I hear about clubs in the EFL always complaining about how, you know, cash flow and how stretched they are and whatever else. I'm just wondering, I'm just thinking out loud here, but this is a club in the seventh tier of English football. And everybody talks about what an important, you know, how what an important part of the community they are and whatever else. But realistically, they're never going to be promoted into the Football League, you know, let alone the Premier League, right? They're almost playing a different sport.
Yeah.
If none of those players were paid, would they still, and because all these guys have day jobs, right?
Yeah, pretty much.
If none of those players were paid, would the club still exist, still have its function in the community? Would they still train twice a week like they do now? Like, what would be different if these guys weren't getting their 200-300 pounds a week?
Well, I mean, these guys need to supplement their income, I guess, and they would find find somewhere else to play.
But they might have that money to pay their rent or to pay their mortgage.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and I think a lot of it is, you know, a lot of it at this level is it's people with clinging onto the dreams that they had when they were teenagers that they could make a career in the game, and obviously they can't. But the Radcliffe captain, it was quite an interesting story. He was the captain of Bury at the start of the season when Bury went into liquidation, well, were kicked out of the league. So he lost his job in September when Bury were kicked out of the league, and now he's joined Radcliffe as captain, and all of a sudden he finds himself potentially losing his job again, you know, because at that level, footballers, they need to work in the real world, and this is it's great to supplement their income a little bit. And you talk about the focal point of the community. I was in the players' bar, and they still have players' bars at that level. I mean, 20 years ago in the Premier League, it was the case before Arsene Wenger changed everything. But at Radcliffe, they have a players' bar. And again, that's a massive part of raising funds. And next Saturday is due to be the club's 70th anniversary. So they had a night planned where live entertainment and hot food and all this kind of thing. And people may laugh, but that sort of thing keeps the club going. And the guy who fought the pitch was 76. It's what these people live for.
No, but I get all that. All I'm saying is, do you need to pay people? Like, if you didn't pay people, you didn't pay the players to do this, right? It's just the economics of it. If you didn't pay, could you still have the players' bar and the 76-year-old groundskeeper and whatever? Could you still do that? I mean, would the community benefit be lost? Community benefit be lost
for nothing? You know,
because they love playing football. Because every weekend, millions of people go and play in amateur leagues up and down the country. I mean,
if we're talking
about men who are 28, 30 years old. You know, newsflash, you're not going to go from Radcliffe. Obviously, the Bury captain's is a slightly different situation, you're not going to go from Radcliffe to Manchester United, ever, unless you buy a ticket. So, what if, rather than paying these guys £200 a week, you live within your means, you don't create a situation where the club risks going under, you know, every time there's a crisis or there's flooding and you can't play for a month. You know, could you still preserve that whole community sense, that whole value of the club within the community? Could you even take some of the money that you save and spend it on facilities and whatever else? Because these people have no business playing professional football or even semi-professional football.
No, but if you have a remnant of a talent at something, if you're one of these players that almost made it but never did, and you're in your late 20s or early 30s, and you can still make some money out of it, then why shouldn't you do that?
I'm not blaming the players. I'm just wondering about the system that encourages. You've got many more semi-professional clubs now than you had before. The fact that it extends down to the seventh tier of the pyramid, and then every time there's a crisis, these clubs are in danger of going bust.
Yeah, but
I don't know how healthy it is. Why do you need so many professional clubs if they're not sustainable?
There's crisis, and this is an unprecedented crisis. I mean, I think even Championship clubs are going to struggle to get through this, never mind clubs in the seventh tier. But, I was looking at the league, the Northern Premier League, and some of the names in there, they give you a sense of why these teams exist. Atherton Colliery's, which is clearly a team based from the coal mines of Atherton. It's a local pride thing, and if Radcliffe didn't pay these guys wages, they'd go and play for Whitby, they'd go and play for FC United, they'd go and play for somebody else. It's not a charity down there. And like I say, if they have a talent, whatever level it is to do something and be paid for it, then why not? You know, some of these guys are, you know, some of these guys have two or three jobs because the main job doesn't pay enough to pay the bills. So I don't know. I think obviously they're never going to get huge crowds, but it means the world to the 350 people that turn up every week. If you're Ivan the groundsman who's 76 and he's forking the ground at 7:30 on a Saturday morning to make sure the game goes on, that tells you what this thing means. And
I saw that too. The 76-year-old groundsman, he's really following government advice about older people. But whatever. I mean, I guess all I'm saying is, I think it's pretty evident that these clubs are serve a really, really important function in the community. And well, I just wonder if at some point, to preserve that, you need to look at whether they should be semi-professional. Whether
But that's also a reward for your talent. So that if all the clubs that are not in the top four leagues don't pay any wages, so good people, great players, you still have some really good players in the seventh league, seventh division, why wouldn't they not get any money? It's like that. And in also, country. It's like the better you are, the more money you earn playing football, right? That's logical. Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah, and this is basically the, you know. Well, that's probably the wrong word, but this, if you look at the food chain, this is right at the bottom of the food chain in football, but it's still part of the food chain. And, you know, we're talking yesterday on TextCap about the referee, Claudio Gavalucci, which is quite an incredible story. This guy was refereeing Serie A 2 years ago. Now he's refereeing at Stainton Park, Radcliffe on a Saturday afternoon in front of 480 people because he's trying to, keep his refereeing career going in the UK, having left Italy. And it's an incredible story, but that this gives the guy the opportunity to do that, even if it's so far down the leagues.
And also, those clubs get better sponsorship money. Some people come and sponsor their club because the level is better than in the 15th division.
I'm just wondering if all those resources, all those wages, which go to your backup right back, go on making sure the club is on really solid footing so that it doesn't disappear from one day to the next because a developer buys the ground to go build a supermarket or whatever because you're behind
on... It's like that, right?
Yeah, you would hope, clubs go under every day because
So many of these clubs survive. The hand to mouth existed, but they still survive. They find a way to survive. So it obviously does work.
I would like to make it
easier
for these clubs to survive. That's all I'm saying.
Gab is running for head of the FA in the next election, and he's got plenty of
ruthless.
Ideas.
I'm gonna sort this stuff up. Augie, thanks so much.
No worries, guys.
Thanks.
Check out Augie's piece. It's on the website. I thought it was an interesting read, Jules. I've seen football at that level. There's obviously a hardcore that of support in small towns, less so in bigger cities. Obviously, it serves a really important function. You just hope that the players' health isn't put at risk because, tell you what, they sure as hell don't have fancy medical insurance like your buddies at Arsenal.
No, and there was a few games on Saturday through the country in the 5th and 6th division, like Ogie just said, 7th division. The one in Hampton and Richmond Borough FC, so in South London, 3,500 people turned up for that game in the 6th division. And, you know, apart from the fact that, yeah, we all miss football and people wanted to go and watch whatever game was on, it could have been anything, they went, but there was also a lot of, you know, safety reasons and safety common sense that maybe could have come into mind of people.
Hi, Jules. Enough of this seventh tier nonsense and the 76-year-old groundsman. Come on, man. How about some quick hits instead? Now, Jose Mourinho, we told you this was coming. He bemoaned the injury crisis that Tottenham were facing when they got knocked out by Leipzig and said every player on the Leipzig bench would have gotten into his Spurs 11 in this moment, meaning with Bergwijn and Kane and those guys out. Jules, I'm just going to remind you of who was on that bench. Amadou Haidara, Yusuf Poulsen, well, at least he's a striker. Emil Forsberg, maybe a couple years ago. Yeah. Tyler Adams, fair enough. Ademola Lookman, it's stretch. Danny Olmo, not this version. And finally, somebody named Yvonne Mvogo, who I'm just going to assume that you know because I see he's francophone.
Of course.
Is he better than Hugo Lloris?
He's not better than Hugo Lloris. No. Although Hugo Lloris made a couple of mistakes in that game.
Hugo Lloris was terrible.
But that was exactly this is the Jose Mourinho tactics of, okay, I messed up again. So what am I going to do? I'm going to throw my players under the bus. So he also said in the same interview, my players have potential. But right now, they can't express their potential. Well, whose fault is that if they can't express their potential? What is your job if you can't?
It's Harry Kane's fault because he's injured.
Yeah, exactly. Well, yeah, he can't express his potential because he's injured. I mean, on that list, Dani Olmo is...
In terms of talent, yes.
Yeah, but he's typically the kind of player that Spurs could have gone and get. Instead, they went to get Jadon Fernandes.
He's also the kind of player that you know Mourinho would like.
Yeah, exactly, as well. too much creativity, too much flair, too skinny, doesn't run enough, or at least not for what I want him to run for. So it's a big no. listen.
Lookman looks like a child.
Yeah, I mean, Tyler Adams just come back from a long-term injury, so maybe he's thinking, I just don't, it doesn't make any sense. And again, it's to deflect from his own mess and his own failure that he used things like this.
I'm not as down on just as you are. I think July 1st, well, maybe, who knows, given the situation we're in. He said, big reset button next season, judge him then. I'll be really curious to see what he puts together.
Our colleague John Sutcliffe is reporting that Liga MX owners are still considering a merger with MLS, Major League Soccer, after the 2026 World Cup that will be organized by Canada, Mexico, and the US as well. So maybe the start of the partnership is there. Gab, do you think it will happen? And two, is it a good idea?
I mean, there's so many details to be ironed out here because you're talking 50 teams. It would be 20 teams from Liga MX joining the 30 MLS teams, which I believe, I'm trying to think if I've forgotten somebody, but I think it's 27 US teams and 3 Canadian teams. I don't know. It's a good idea, but I don't want to see something that's just driven by money. I'd want some real answers. Promotion and relegation.
Yeah, so you could make 2 divisions, maybe even 3 divisions. And in that case, yeah, MLS is a closed league now. It would open up.
I think it would need to happen. I mean, you know, obviously there's been a judgment. Obviously MLS continues, or some owners continue to insist that it's not viable, blah, 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 without promotion and relegation. You know what? If you merge with a real league that's a historic league that's been around for I don't know how many years, you have to accept those concepts.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I don't know, again, 50 teams. I don't know how you do it. I don't know travel-wise how it would work out. Obviously, you would have to have different tiers to it.
Yeah.
But then again, that's kind of, even if you have promotion relegation within those 50 teams, then you have the same problem. Why do I, owner of FC Cincinnati or whatever the hell it's called, or Minnesota United, who I've just plunked down $150 million. Why do I want to be in the third tier of a new MLS, Liga MX or MX
merger? Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah,
playing against, you know, Tigres. I don't know. I mean, is this what I signed up for? No. I'm glad that they're talking. You know why they're talking.
Yeah.
They're talking about money. I think obviously this would need a lot of regulatory approval from CONCACAF, obviously from the 2 federations. I hope they think this through very, very clearly. And I hope they think it through about, you know, in terms of what actually benefits the growth of the game. Maybe it is something like this, if you open up the pyramid further. But, you know, you think of the travel times, the distances. I don't know. It feels like a land grab. I need to see a concrete proposal.
You know, I watched Liga MX at the weekend on Sunday morning. I watched Juarez against Tigres because Andre Piergignac, the French striker, scored again for Tigres. And that was a really good game. It's a really good league, I think.
Well, Gignac, it was funny because he's somebody I said, all right, when he went to Mexico, all right, first of all, I thought Gignac was just kind of like, you know, a refrigerator-sized man with 1 foot who doesn't run. And I thought, all right, what the hell are you doing in Mexico, given the climate and the weather and stuff like that?
I think he thought the same, to be fair, when he joined.
Man, he's proven me wrong.
God, yeah, 5 years, almost 5 years he's been there. Now
he loves it, banging in goals.
Yeah, I think he's 110 goals since he arrived. And obviously he became Tigres' record goal scorer in the history, I think a few weeks ago. And in 2020, at the age of almost 35, he's still banging the goals. It's crazy.
What a story that is.
It's an incredible story. For someone who was so attached to the southeast of France, you know, where he grew up, obviously at Marseille and that love story there, to move all the other side of the world in Mexico, not speaking the language or anything.
Okay, because that's really hard to pick up Spanish when you're French.
No, but it doesn't matter. It's still like, we see a lot of players struggling in another country, culture and everything. But to have that kind of impact, to be loved the way he is, to love, you know, that country and that city, Monterrey, as much as he, I mean, I think it's wonderful.
How many center forwards need to get injured before Deschamps gives him a call?
Oh, I don't know, a lot.
Giroud,
but you know, he's
Mbappe.
The man. He's the man forever who would be the man who hit the post in the Euros final, 2016 final, when the score was 0-0. If that shot, and it's a tough shot, and he does everything so well against Portugal, but for five centimeters on the right, he goes in and he's a national hero. It's crazy.
Do you think Deschamps would still hold that against him?
I don't think he would. They had a really on and off relationship for many years, but imagine if like they would
make a list. I mean, not now.
No, but
tell me how many people need to get injured.
Yeah,
I'm assuming obviously Giroud, Mbappe,
Griezmann,
Plea.
Plea, maybe Moussa Dembélé, the Lyon Moussa Dembélé. I even think like someone like Hudson Edouard, who's doing so well at Celtic, might just be ahead of Jean. I mean, it's a long shot.
You mentioned five people. There's not that many.
Yeah,
I'm sure there's
Ben
people Yedder, you're forgetting.
Yeah, Ben Yedder. So there's a few like that. But
six. Isn't it take four, five?
Maybe.
Okay, but we know one guy that Gignac is definitely ahead of, and that's Karim Benzema.
No, of course. Of course.
Now, Galatasaray and Besiktas might have been the last major game played in Europe for a while. Jews, as we've just seen, you're addicted to football, so I bet you were watching.
Yeah. I mean, I watched highlights of the Russian league as well, and the Zenit win, and Malcolm scoring his first goal.
Zenit destroyed Ural, was it, like 6-1?
Malcolm scored, you know, the like famous transfer from Barcelona in the summer, then
Malcolm
he wanted to leave.
Was an imaginary player.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. And you had two huge games in Turkey. You had not just the Galatasaray Besiktas, the Istanbul derby that finished 0-0. That was dire. That was really, really bad.
As bad as Eric.
Yeah, as bad as Eric. With no fans either, in an empty stadium, like hardly no shot on target. It was just like, but before that, you also had first against second. Trabzonspor against Başakşehir with a few former Premier League players. Martin Skrtel scored a known goal against Başakşehir for Trabzonspor. Then Baba scored for Başakşehir as well. Gael Clichy was there.
Who has a girl's name?
Yeah, I know, but
Jonathan Mikel, who's got two names,
was on the bench and who's not happy, by the way, that the league is still going on in Turkey. And neither Radamel Falcao, who played for Galatasaray in the evening. So 1-1, this one finished a bit better than the Galatasaray Besiktas, but. You know, when there's no football, you have to find some football. So Ukraine played as well, Serbia played as well, and then River Plate. Did you see that? Didn't play in South America.
Well, now I think that both Argentina and Brazil have been suspended.
But they were not suspended the weekend, and Atletico Tucumán came to Buenos Aires to play against River Plate with the referee. But River Plate had warned them before, we're not going to play, we don't want to play that game. So the stadium was locked, and there was no games. And now I think River will be hit by a very, very, very big fine for refusing to play that game. Basically, the game was on. It was officially on, and they refused to play, locked down the stadium because, obviously, of the virus and all the implication in terms of health that could occur. So that's one to follow up. But, yeah, no games at River Plate.
But plenty of footballers exercising on social media.
Of course. And Dries Mertens lifting magnums of wine on his balcony overlooking the Bay of Naples. Sergio Ramos huffing and puffing away on his treadmill. We saw Reguilón and Iglesias playing a Sevilla Betis game on FIFA 20 live on Twitch as well, if you watch that on Sunday night. Gab, what's your favorite footballer training at home video?
I watched a bunch of these last night. They all kind of, I love the creativity of it. Obviously, Ciro Mertens, Dries Mertens.
Yeah.
I mean, that was just so appropriate. Him
that
out
was
there.
So cool.
Like, you know, lifting his giant bottle of wine. Like we touched upon this before. We're going to see wackiness like this. These guys are pros. They're doing the best they can. Some of them have gardens where they can run around in.
Yeah.
Many of them don't.
Play.
It's as simple as that. And how they're going to go and figure this out, I don't know, but certainly keeping us entertained.
The one of Karim Benzema, I think the first day of his quarantine, well, you know, the training ground is closed. And after just a few hours, he posted that video in French going like, this is too hard. I'm bored. It's only a few hours and I'm just bored already. I don't know what to do. And I think that's the thing as well, is that there will be a point where they still have to exercise a little bit, like we said, but they would be missing training and playing so much that they won't know what to do.
Well, I think it's safe to say we all miss it. We all miss them. But as we said at the top of the show, public health comes first. So we're going to be back hopefully on Wednesday to fill you in on what comes out of the big UEFA meeting.
Yeah.
In the meantime, stay safe and we'll catch you then.